Madam President, Excellencies, Honorable Ministers, Excellencies, Ambassadors, Distinguished Delegates, Friends and Colleagues in Public Health, Ladies and Gentlemen, good afternoon. This is the sixth time I have addressed the Health Assembly in my capacity as Director General. I still get nervous. But I do have some important messages to convey. In public health, decades sometimes acquire labels. The 1970s were a decade of hope, culminating in the Health for All movement under Dr. Mahler's leadership. That hope was quickly followed by an oil crisis, a debt crisis, an economic recession, and the imposition of structural adjustment programs, which forced governments to cut budgets for social services, including health. The 1980s became known as the lost decade for development. After a long span of steady progress, large parts of the developing world slipped back into deeper poverty. Health services, staff or funds, began to crumble. That damage, ladies and gentlemen, was inherited by the next decade. With few exceptions, progress in public health was slow during the 1990s, with health seen as an expenditure rather than an investment. The first decade of 21st century has also acquired a label. Many described it as the golden age for health development, and rightly so. For the first time, health moved to the top of the development agenda, thanks to the work of Dr. Brundtland, including the report she commissioned on macroeconomics and health. At the start of the decade, the Millennium Development Goals show how much the perception of health had changed, from a drain on resources to a driver of socio-economic progress. In that golden decade, governments in both donor and recipient countries make the health agenda a top priority. Money for health development more than tripled. Substantial results follow, with a particularly strong impact on deaths from HIV/AIDS, tuberculosis, malaria, and childhood illness. The MDGs unleash the best in human ingenuity and creativity, leaving a legacy of innovations. The list is long. It includes new vaccines, new medicines and diagnostics, new ways of stimulating research and development for diseases of the poor, and new ways of financing health development, like Gavi, the Global Fund, and UNITAID. The decade is over, and some observers will tell you that the golden age of health development has also come to an end. And bitter observers say what many suspect may be true. A financial crisis derailed the best chance ever to alleviate poverty and give this lopsided world fairness and balance. Greater fairness and balance. I strongly disagree. I believe the best days for health are yet to come. They are ahead of us, not behind us. It is true that money is tight and the future of the world economic situation looks uncertain. Health officials, development partners, and WHO are watching money closely. Money, of course, is important, but many other factors drive progress in public health. During my recent visits to countries, I have seen inspiring examples of success. Striking achievements within countries make me optimistic. The unprecedented momentum for better health that marked the start of this century continues, though on a different footing, sometimes on an even surer footing. Ladies and gentlemen, time and time again, we see the importance of national ownership and leadership. India would never have been able to dramatically change the prospects for polio eradication without full government ownership of the program. The government of India deserves our congratulations for this monumental achievement. Ghana. Ghana's commitment to guinea worm eradication shrunk the map to its last outpost, the South Sudan. During the first quarter of 2012, cases of this disease dropped by 67% compared with last year, and now number just over 100. I visited Namibia in April. That country's Minister of Health, an expert in vector control, is leading a group of 8 neighboring African countries in a joint effort to eliminate malaria within the next few years. WHO has produced a complete set of technical manuals for testing, treating, and tracking to guide them on their way. These countries are ambitious, and they are determined. Their eyes are wide open to the challenge, but the chances of success are good. Last month, I also visited Oman, where I learned about the outcome of an EU-WHO initiative to build country capacity to respond to outbreaks or natural disasters. This is a splendid example of whole-of-government approach, with more than 30 government sectors and departments working together to build resilience. In its fight to wrap a deadly product in a plain package, Australia leads resistance to the tobacco industry. That is a commendable effort. Let's do it. Let's do it together. No government in this world, when they are taking good public health measures to protect its people, should be intimidated by an industry, especially the big tobacco. During negotiations on pandemic influenza preparedness, Indonesia, joined by many others, pushed for a fairer and more equitable system that shares responsibilities and access to benefits on an equal footing. The result is a pioneering framework that extends traditional cooperation in the health-related public sectors to include annual contributions and firm commitments from private industry in the name of health. Given my commitment to women, I am grateful to the Nordic countries and to Canada for their unwavering promotion of women empowerment, gender equity, and human rights, and for leading by example. Several recent studies have advised the international community to look to BRICS countries, namely Brazil, the Russian Federation, India, China, and South Africa, as a way to maintain the momentum for better health. These countries have become the biggest suppliers of essential medicines in affordable generic forms to the greatest benefit of the developing world. BRICS countries also offer an alternative model for health development, including technology transfer, based more on equal partnerships than on the traditional donor-recipient model. Some of these countries need support in upgrading quality standards and improving regulatory control. WHO is providing this support. Last year, after extensive technical collaboration, WHO pre-qualified China's Safe Food and Drug Administration. Once individual vaccines are pre-qualified by the World Health Organization, the country's capacity to produce a large number of vaccines at very low prices will revolutionize vaccine supplies and their prices. I am further encouraged by the high place health is given in many regional political and economic unions and by international organs. Last November, I addressed members of the UN Security Council. I drew their attention to the threat posed by emerging and epidemic-prone diseases and reassured them. Habito uses a sophisticated electronic surveillance system to gather disease intelligence in real time. We are rarely taken by surprise. WHO can mount an international response within 24 hours. This is because of your support through the WHO Global Outbreak Alert and Response Network, but also the capacity of our country offices to get visas for our experts, to move supplies through customs, and coordinate every step of the way with the Ministry of Health. No other agency can do this. You will be receiving progress report in building the capacities needed to implement the international health regulations. And I look to you for further advice and guidance and see how WHO can support you further to fully implement the core capacities as required by the IHR 2005. Ladies and gentlemen, we see WHO leadership at work, often bringing outsized results for small but smart investments. Africa's new meningitis vaccine, developed in a project coordinated by the World Health Organization and CAF, is being rolled out, promising to end seasonal epidemics in Africa's meningitis belt, benefiting more than 20 countries. The payback will be enormous. A single dose of meningitis vaccine can cost a household the equivalent of 3 to 4 months of income, and mounting an emergency immunization campaign to control an outbreak can cost a country as much as 5% of its entire health budget. Just imagine, an innovation can bring payback, huge payback in terms of savings. WHO leadership brought the neglected tropical diseases from obscurity into the limelight. These, what we call Cinderella diseases, long ignored and underappreciated, are a rags to riches story. In January, a pharmaceutical company pledged to step up its contribution of preventive treatment for schistosomiasis by tenfold, reaching 100 million treatments per year by 2016. WHO administers the distribution of the majority of drugs donated to control the neglected tropical diseases. With the January commitment, ladies and gentlemen, WHO is now in a position to protect all school-aged children in Africa at risk of schistosomiasis. Isn't this wonderful news? We can blanket this part of the world with medicines that rid every school child of worms and eggs and parasites that interfere their learning, impair cognitive development, and compromise their nutritional status. This is a gift to their health, but also to the education and nutrition sectors. Last year, WHO recommended a ban on inaccurate and costly commercial blood tests for diagnosing active tuberculosis. And last week, I'm very happy to hear that the country with the largest use of these tests, costly and inaccurate tests, especially by private practitioners, announced legislation banning the tests nationwide. More than a million of these misleading blood tests are carried out each year, often at great danger and great cost to patients, who may have to pay up to $30 per test. Think of what we are saving. Following publication of the 2010 World Health Report on health system financing, more than 60 countries in this organization have approached WHO seeking technical support for their plans to move towards universal coverage. What we are seeing goes against the historical pattern, where social services shrink when money gets tight. I think this drive to expand coverage is a very powerful signal. Despite deepening financial austerity, the will to do the right thing, the fair thing, for people's health prevails. All of these examples, all of my personal experiences over the past 5 years, bring me to one overarching conclusion. Universal health coverage is the single most powerful concept that public health has to offer. Universal coverage is relevant to every person on this planet. It is a powerful equalizer that abolishes distinctions between the rich and the poor, the privileged and the marginalized, the young and the old, ethnic groups, and women and men. Universal health coverage is the best way to cement gains made during the previous decade. It is the ultimate expression of fairness. This is the anchor for the work of WHO as we move forward. Ladies and gentlemen, these examples give me, personally, great cause for optimism during what many regard as an especially dismal time. They also provide guidance on strategies and approaches that help maintain the momentum for health in the years ahead. I can suggest 3 general lines of advice. First, get back to the basics, like primary health care, access to essential medicines, and universal coverage. Shift to thrift. Develop a thirst for efficiency and an intolerance of waste. When a government commits itself to universal coverage, it takes a hard look at waste and inefficiency, and it shifts to thrift. At the international level, this means making good use of initiatives like the International Health Partnership Plus and the Harmonization for Health in Africa. This means streamlining and integrating health programs, as is being done with plans to ensure that every baby is born HIV-free. This means putting countries in the driver's seat, giving them full ownership of what is being done for the health of their people. This is now what a government needs. A government needs to earn the trust and confidence of its citizens, the voters. This means using WHO country offices as well as a resource for policy dialogue and coordination, and for making sure that aid for health development moves countries towards self-reliance. Good aid is channeled in ways that strengthen existing infrastructures and capacities. Good aid aims to eliminate the need for aid. Second, as public expectations rise, costs soar, and budgets shrink, we must look to innovation as never before. And I mean the right kind of innovation. Innovation does the most good when it responds to societal concerns and societal needs, and not just to the prospects of making a profit. These days, the true genius of innovation resides in simplicity. This is not rocket science. This is frugal, strategic innovation that sets out to develop a game-changing intervention and makes ease of use and affordable price explicit objectives. We are seeing a new wave of innovation that I believe the commissioners on social determinants of health would welcome. And on that, I want to appreciate the very successful meeting in Rio on the social determinant of health, thanks to you, Brazil. Now, the social determinants of health teaches one thing. We must look beyond the causes of preventable deaths and look at the real reasons behind these causes. Let me give you an example. Obstructed labor is a major killer of young women and adolescent girls. The real reasons are these: poverty and health systems that are impoverished by the lack of medicines, equipment, skill staff, and transportation. The Odon device, developed by the World Health Organization and now undergoing clinical trials, offer a low-cost, simplified way to deliver babies and protect mothers when labor is prolonged and obstructed. It promises to transfer life-saving capacity to rural health posts, which almost never have the facilities and the staff to perform a cesarean section. If approved, the Odon device will be the first simple new tools for assisted delivery since forceps and vacuum extractors. These were introduced centuries ago. As we promote primary health care and universal coverage, we must not let a deteriorating economic outlook compromise the quality of clinical care. Primary health care is not cheap, and it must not be a B-team version of what people get when they pay for private care. We must never forget the importance of high-quality clinical care. Here, too, frugal innovation helps. Just a few years ago, WHO estimated that surgical errors or surgical mistakes were killing around 1 million people worldwide each year. To address this problem, WHO adopted a simple checklist used by pilots in the airline industry, one of the safest industries in the world. The WHO Safe Surgery Checklist was introduced in 2008 and has since been widely applied, significantly reducing surgical errors. Studies suggest that, if fully implemented, nearly half of those 1 million deaths would be averted. Building on this success, WHO has developed a safe childbirth checklist to address the huge burden of preventable maternal and newborn deaths, especially in low-income settings. What good does it make? What good does it do to offer free maternal care and have a high proportion of babies delivered in health facilities if the quality of care is substandard or even dangerous? A pilot study of the checklist concluded, you know, in India initially, and it was published last week, demonstrated 150% increase in adherence to accepted clinical practices for maternal and perinatal care in an institutional setting. And ladies and gentlemen, and this improvement in care was done at no additional resource investment, just a paper checklist, like what pilots are doing. A large randomized control trial is underway to quantify the impact on reducing morbidity and mortality, but results will take some time. In the meantime, WHO will soon release the checklist as part of a call for collaborative research, and I welcome your participation. There is, ladies and gentlemen, another good reason to promote frugal innovation. Unlike other areas of technology development, like computers or mobile phones, advances in medical products nearly always come with greater complexity and a much higher price tag. The complexity increases the price further, as highly skilled staff are needed. At some point, we come up against a brick wall. We're delivering care for NCDs, especially cancer, or care for people with mental disorders, especially elderly people with dementia, becomes unaffordable, even in the world's wealthiest countries. To counter this trend, WHO has launched an initiative to develop appropriate assistive devices for the world's rapidly aging populations. These are things like mobile phones adapted for the visually impaired and robust low-cost hearing aids. Affordability is important, but so are simplicity and ease of use, as this relieves some of the pressure on specialized care and further reduce healthcare costs. Imagine the impact on the well-being and quality of life. In developing countries, WHO estimates that nearly 40% of people older than 65 years, I qualify for that, WHO estimates that nearly 40% of people older than 65 years have a disabling hearing impairment. And this is serious. My third advice is brief, ladies and gentlemen. Use research. Use science. Shape the research agenda and seize off every opportunity opened by new findings. WHO does this most conspicuously when it revised policy and technical guidance for HIV/AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria. As just one example, evidence indicates that the elimination of mother-to-child transmission of HIV is entirely feasible, and this is now our operational goal. This is part of efficiency. Science makes the breakthroughs. Public health operationalizes them and leaps ahead. Ladies and gentlemen, the past year has seen some good news for health, and we are right to be encouraged. But there are at least two danger zones, and they are big ones. Our traditional financial donors are under intense domestic pressure to demonstrate that official development assistance is being wisely invested. Taxpayers and parliamentarians want to see quick, tangible, and measurable results that demonstrate payback for the money. This is understandable. This can be dangerous, especially for a disease like HIV/AIDS. In a sense, we are in the best position ever to get ahead of this devastating epidemic and put its heavy burden behind us. Evidence continues to mount that antiretroviral therapy not only saves lives, but is also a powerful prevention tool, reducing sexual transmission of HIV by as much as 96%. Unfortunately, it is highly unlikely that the established goal for universal access to antiretroviral therapy will be met. We have good reasons to believe that the UN target of having 15 million people on treatment by 2015 will not be met. In these difficult financial times, I see an extremely dangerous tendency to measure how much health can be bought for a given amount of money. Saving a life with a vaccine is unquestionably far cheaper and more immediate than keeping someone with AIDS alive. It is also less demanding on the health systems. In my view, human life cannot be valued or devalued or discounted in this way. These medicines are a lifeline for a lifetime. The only ethically acceptable exit strategy is to stop new infections in the first place. We have that opportunity, open even wider by evidence of the effectiveness of male and female condoms, harm reduction, behavioral change, and male circumcision. The critical question is this: will we seize this opportunity or let it slip away through our fingers? The second danger zone should be obvious to anybody who pays attention to WHO's monitoring of global health trends. This monitoring tells us where we are making progress, but also which health threats cast the longest and the biggest shadow over progress. And this is the biggest one. The longest dark shadow, the relentless rise of chronic non-communicable diseases. Last week's World Health Statistics report created a stir, and rightly so. WHO data shows that rates of obesity nearly double in every region of the world from 1980 to 2008. Worldwide, one in three adults have raised blood pressure. One in 10 adults have diabetes. These are the diseases that tax health systems to the breaking point. These are the diseases that break the bank. And these are the diseases that can cancel out the gains of modernization and development. And these are the diseases that can set back all the hard work that you have done in poverty alleviation. and push millions of people below the poverty line each year. Last year's political declaration on NCDs assigned a number of responsibilities to WHO. And you have before you a report on the multiple steps WHO has taken to meet these expectations. I can assure you, we are giving these diseases and our role in their prevention and control the utmost priority. Ladies and gentlemen, I have a final comment as we think together about WHO reform. I see the role of WHO as that of a global health guardian, a protector and defender of health, including the right to health. WHO is a custodian of technical expertise, but also of values like social justice, equity, including gender equity. We must never forget our value system. Never forget the people. Public health is trained in compassion and driven by passion. This will always be our strength, our true comparative advantage. Persuading others to share this value system is another way to maintain the momentum for better health. This happened most recently with human African trypanosomiasis. Late-stage sleeping sickness is invariably fatal. Drugs are donated for treatment, but what good do they do if cases are detected too late? Understanding this, the company donating the drugs also gives WHO the funds needed to support active screening, and that is to pay for the facilities, equipment, logistics, staff, and their training. Industry commitment continues because my staff took the company CEO and senior executive on a field trip to Africa last month. These executives saw the people, the illness, the lumbar puncture done under the mango trees. Far too many of us live in settings where lumbar punctures are done in very sophisticated settings. Doing lumbar puncture under a mango tree, these are the settings we are dealing with. Seeing the illness, the lumbar puncture done under the tree, the cases detected, and the medicines given to save people's lives. Seeing the people bringing these people eye to eye with their mystery has the great power to motivate the right kind of public-private partnership. Results build trust, and with trust, commitment continues and escalates. Let me conclude by thanking all my member states for so carefully and diligently shepherding change as this organization undergoes the most extensive reforms in its history. We all know that this is not an easy process, but it must be done, and it must be done right. And I would like to thank all my regional directors and all my staff for their good work, dedication, commitment to WHO, and their support for this reform. I thank as well the permanent missions here in Geneva and their ambassadors. You have no idea how hard they work. So ministers of health, please give them a pat on their shoulders. I want to thank them, you know, the ambassadors and their teams for investing so much time in supporting the work of this organization. I personally believe that WHO does great good in this world by improving the organization's operational effectiveness and strategically positioning our work. We can do more. The world expects this and needs this from WHO. We will not let the people down. Thank you.